The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we're gathered to learn about one of the great works of Russian literature and the man who wrote it and the events that led to its creation. Our guide is Kevin Birmingham, the author of The Most Dangerous Book, a work a review in the Washington Post describes as a lively and impressively researched history of James Joyce's Ulysses. A New York Times bestseller, it won the Penn New England Award and the Truman Capote Award for literary criticism. Birmingham's other writing has appeared in such periodicals as the New York Times Book Review and Harper's, and he was named a public scholar by the National Endowment for the Humanities. His latest book, The Sinner and the Saint, reveals the incredible true story of the notorious 1830s Parisian murderer who inspired Fyodor Dostoevsky's magnum opus, Crime and Punishment. One reviewer writes, "This wonderfully pungent book presents Dostoevsky's extraordinary life in the most vivid detail imaginable. Birmingham puts you in the room when Raskolnikov brings down the axe, and he puts you there too when the novelist discovers the face of redemptive love." The author of those lines is tonight's conversant, Michael Gora, the Mary Augusta Jordan Professor of English Language and Literature at Smith College, and the editor of the Norton critical editions of As I Lay Dying and The Sound and the Fury, and most recently, the author of The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War. Thank you both so much for joining us. The screen is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy. And Kevin, it's great to be here and talking with you tonight. And as Andy was speaking, I was struck again by your two titles, both of which have an edge to them, The Most Dangerous Book, and then The Sinner and the Saint. And as he was speaking, I started to think, well, Crime and Punishment is a pretty dangerous book, in some ways more dangerous than Ulysses, but The Sinner and the Saint, of course, Dostoevsky was both in a way, wasn't he?
Yes. In fact, you know, as I was writing, I was hoping that readers would sort of see eventually that The Sinner and the Saint are two elements of Dostoevsky himself, mm-hmm. rather than Dostoevsky being the saint and the sinner being Lacenaire, the French murderer, who was the partial inspiration for Crime and Punishment. So in a way, you're ahead of the game. Dostoevsky is, I think, famous for thinking of human beings as being complicated people, being of at least two minds, if not more. The struggle within him was, I think, something that he struggled with throughout his life, and he used writing as a way to, I think, exercise the demons inside him. He had, I think, impulses that he was not proud of, impulses that he couldn't help but explore. And in Crime and Punishment, I feel as if Dostoevsky is trying to do that. He's trying to understand what it is like to be on both sides of the equation of a murder, right? To be both the murder victim and the perpetrator. And this is partly because, you know, as a young man, if you know anything about Dostoevsky's life, his life itself was incredible. And when he was still in his 20s, he was almost executed. He thought that he was going to be executed. He was arrested by the Tsar, and he was out in the middle of a square in St. Petersburg. Three men in front of him were tied to stakes with hoods put over their heads and facing a firing squad. And at the last minute, the Tsar's envoy galloped into the square and said that by the Tsar's great mercy, instead of all of these suspects being executed, they were going to be sent to Siberia for 10 years. So he felt the fear of dying, of being executed, but he also felt this bizarre impulse towards aggression that he tried to fight throughout his life.
Can you remind me why he was arrested and put in prison and went through that mock execution? What led to that?
Yeah, so he was a part of, I suppose you could call it a reading group, a progressive reading group called the Petrushevsky Circle, right? And it was named the Petrushevsky Circle after the host, Petrushevsky, who, you know, had it in his apartment. And they were reading books that were forbidden at the time. There were quite a few books published in Europe and in the United States that were not legal to read, anything that smacked of revolution, anything that talked about democracy or socialism or constitutions or legislative assemblies. Dostoevsky was very interested in these ideas, even ideas that smacked of atheism. And as time went on, the reading circle got more and more explicitly political and started talking more explicitly about the problems, the contemporary problems of Russia. And Dostoevsky was vehemently opposed to serfdom. His father was rumored to have been killed by his own serfs, so that may have fueled his hatred for serfdom. And he effectively read out a letter that a critic had written to Gogol, and it was a scathing indictment of Tsarist Russia and the institution of serfdom. And in the small audience that was listening to Dostoevsky speak was a spy for the Tsar. And shortly after he read those statements, he was woken up in the middle of the night in the hours before dawn by the Tsar's secret police and arrested. He spent 9 months in a prison by himself and nearly 10 years in Siberia, four of which were in a hard labor prison camp.
It's the way the Secret Service likes to come, I guess. In the middle of the night, the secret police. That's when they always come, or so I've heard. But there's something counterintuitive about this, because you know, one of the other things Dostoevsky's famous for, aside from you know being arrested and almost and you know mock execution and so on, is he was arrested as a radical, but he's known in later life as a great conservative. He's flirting with atheism when he's young, and later in life as the great novelist, he's somebody who is a devout Christian. I think at one point he said that if the truth could be shown not to be with Christ, he would rather be wrong with Christ than right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The trajectory, you know, of his life, he ends up drifting further and further rightward. He's part of a pretty long history of people who are imprisoned and then start to identify with the regime that imprisoned them to some degree. Now he was.
Is this Stockholm syndrome for Dostoevsky?
I suppose so, but it was made easier by the fact that you know as he was coming back, when he came back to St. Petersburg, to European Russia, it was you know the tail end of 1859, 1860. He was encountering a completely different Russia than the Russia that he left. So there was a new czar, it was Tsar Alexander II, and he was more liberal than his predecessor. The serfs were very soon emancipated. And so that sin, I suppose you could call it, of the Russian Empire was now taken away. And there were at least moments of liberalism and reform that were happening throughout Russia that I think pacified the older generation, people of Dostoevsky's age, but did not pacify the younger generation. So part of what made him a little bit more conservative is that he was reacting a bit against the nihilists, as they were called, of the 1860s. So one of the things that's happening is that when he looks at the younger generation of people, he's looking at people who are a little bit like himself, and he sort of realizes the folly of what he's done, that he effectively nearly threw his life away for an idea. And this way of going about change in Russian society is as the era of that was something that stuck with Dostoevsky for a long time. The idea of changing a society from the top down, from beginning with a philosophy and then imposing that philosophy or those ideas onto people, was something that he thought was completely wrong. That if you wanted to change the way people behaved, if you wanted to change a system, you had to work from the bottom up. And that partly ends up having conservative manifestations because it resembles what, you know, in the United States would have been called a go slow approach to integration or something like that, where The idea of revolutionary change was something that was anathema to Dostoevsky, but was very much in the air in the 1860s.
Mm-hmm. And anathema because he'd been stung by it himself.
Yeah, that's right.
In a way, yeah, yeah. So you mentioned the nihilists, and can you remind us who they were, what they believed, and yeah. If they believed anything? I mean, the word suggests they didn't believe anything, but I know that's not true.
No, that's, well, so the term nihilist now is used very loosely, but at the time it was something very specific. What it meant was that you wouldn't take anything on faith alone, that anything that you would believe in would only be something that your senses proved to you or that you found through evidence, right? Turgenev was the person who popularized the term nihilist, and he did it in his novel, Fathers and Children. And it was meant as a criticism, but the nihilists took it as a badge of honor. That's right. We don't take anything on faith. We don't take God on faith. We don't take tradition on faith. We don't take natural rights on faith. We don't take the right of the czar to rule over people on faith. We don't take the fact that the landowners have so much control in Russia on faith. Anything that we're going to believe is valuable has to be something that is proven to us. So in a way, it was a radical skepticism, but it became so radical that it was a form of solipsism almost, where no one would accept any fact that was arrived at by a community, like by a scientific community, right? So, you know, we are surrounded by very complicated facts that we more or less take on faith, right? The fact that there is a pandemic that is sweeping the world isn't something that I have immediate access to from my house in Boston, but it is something that I will accept on faith because other people have arrived at these conclusions. Mm-hmm. So it was a potentially self-defeating premise where it favored individualism to such a degree that it was destructive. And Dostoevsky saw that within nihilism, there was an egoism. And those two strands of European thought started to merge in Russia. And that was one of the things that Dostoevsky had his eye on.
Okay, so extreme nihilism and extreme egoism and coming together in Crime and Punishment. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so how do they do that, and how does that filter or play out in the life of Raskolnikov, the main character?
So Raskolnikov is, from the very beginning, from the novel's opening, he's someone who's alone, right? It's the image of Raskolnikov that sticks with people is him lying on a divan in his small garret of a room. It's sometimes described as a cupboard or a coffin, where he has no close connections to anyone. There are some distant connections that he has, but they're falling away, right? He has his family, he has old friends that are there that are trying to reach him, but he's isolated himself and has suffused himself with ideas and has convinced himself that you could be an altruistic murderer, right? If you could murder a pawnbroker, for example. Pawnbrokers were predatory. They were feeding off of the misfortunes of the poorest people in society. They were making money off of them. And Raskolnikov thinks, well, look, if you kill not only a pawnbroker, but a very old pawnbroker, someone who's close to dying anyway, and use that money for vague benevolent purposes, then it would be worthwhile. It's a morally justifiable thing to do. So that was a form of utilitarianism. Mm-hmm. As the novel goes forward, there are about three or four different philosophical justifications for what's potentially going on or why he would have done this. But when it really comes down to it, at the heart of the novel is that all of these justifications are faulty justifications, that beneath all of it is a sheer self-destructive impulse that Raskolnikov has. And he betrays it briefly in one crucial scene with his love interest, Sonia, that he says to Sonia, you know, the reason why I did it is because I wanted to take everything by the tail and whisk it off to the devil, just to destroy it, to wipe the slate clean. That image of Raskolnikov in particular is what he saw in the nihilists. So when the nihilists were were really making waves in the mid 1860s. He wrote to Katkoff, his editor. He said, you know, what they want to do, the nihilists want to create a paradise out of a tabula rasa. And so there are two parts to that definition of a nihilist. That on the one hand, they want to create a paradise, which is noble, I suppose, even though it's foolhardy, because it's impossible to create a paradise in a fallen world like our own. But on the other hand, it wasn't just out of a tabula rasa. He suspected, or maybe he knew, if you were to agree with him, that there was a joy in wiping everything away, that in just creating the tabula rasa by destroying everything, by breaking civilization down to its core and building all, building everything up again. And it was that destructive impulse at the heart of the idealism that Dostoevsky wanted to recreate in Raskolnikov. And that's the sort of binary that makes the character and the novel compelling.
And what I remember from the novel, and I haven't taught it in a couple of years, is that he suffers because of this, that he believes in his own ideas and then realizes he's destroyed himself. With those through those very ideas.
You know, Dostoevsky likes to paint it as an illness, right? There's a fever. He's he suffers from hallucinations and fever dreams, and the rhetoric surrounding, or the metaphors surrounding Raskolnikov were something that he returned to over and over again. There's a one point where he has a dream. Raskolnikov has a dream of a plague that, you know, comes from the depths of China and sweeps the world, and it's a plague of egoism, where everyone believes that he or she is the source of, the only source of truth. And that profound egoism basically disintegrates all of society. That people can't work together, that you can't have corporations, that you can't have societies, that you can't have agriculture, that you can't have armies. Nothing works when everyone believes that they are alone are the source for truth. And he imagined that as a disease. And of course, in the dream, it's a reversal. It doesn't come from China, it comes from Europe. The disease that he was seeing was something that was European in origin.
Well, as you describe it, I think, it does. It's Hobbesian.
Right, yes.
It's the war of all against all. Right. You know, what I mean, you mentioned Raskolnikov's illness, his sense, and Dostoevsky does describe him always in as being sick, fevered, so on. But one of the things Raskolnikov thinks to himself when he prepares to go kill the pawnbroker is that he will be perfectly calm. He will be perfectly calm, and it's a rational act he's doing. And one reason why he will be perfectly calm is that he will not be disturbed by this, because he's a kind of Superman. And of course, it turns out that he is disturbed, and that shows him that he's not a Superman. Although I've always felt that there's a kind of curious balancing act that Dostoevsky is playing in the novel, where he convinces you that Raskolnikov is indeed extraordinary, an incredible character.
Yes.
But at the same time, he has no right to do what he's doing.
Right. He's talented. He is, we know early on that he is empathetic.
Yeah.
Right. That he's he pays for the funeral of a civil servant who is trampled by horses. He tries to save a drunken young woman on the street. So we know that he has these good impulses, but they're buried beneath this this philosophy, or at least he tries to erect a philosophy that would justify some sort of rash action. But you know, within all of that, the image that may stick in the minds of people who have read, you know, Crime and Punishment, whether it was, you know, last year or 20 years ago, is the image of the top hat that is just worn out and battered. And that image of the battered top hat is the image of a young man who is ambitious, who wants to be a social climber, but who has failed to do that. Raskolnikov is no longer studying law because he couldn't afford to pay the fees, and he's in debt, and his life is spinning out of his control. And there's there's a deep resentment to that fact.
The top hat makes him a kind of intellectual dandy. And
yes,
you know, but it's a decrepit intellectual dandy. Right. He's playing with ideas, but they've had the nap worn off.
And the top hat is actually something that Dostoevsky, well, first Dostoevsky himself had a top hat from that mm-hmm. same tailor from Zimmerman's. But the one of the sources for Crime and Punishment, the murder of Lacenaire, which I, you know, there are two stories in The Sinner and the Saint. One is about Dostoevsky as a young writer, Dostoevsky as a novelist who is creating one particular novel, Crime and Punishment. But it also goes back and forth between Dostoevsky's story and the story of this murderer, Pierre-François Lacenaire. Mm-hmm. He came across this story in 1861 in a compendium of true crime stories, sensational true crime stories. The story was illustrated. And there are a lot of, you know, really incredible illustrations, I think. But in several of the illustrations, actually the cover of my book is yeah. one of the illustrations. It's altered. There's a little bit of sleight of hand where this is Lacenaire, but Lacenaire didn't actually kill with an axe. It was his partner who killed with an axe. He killed with a three-sided file. So, but anyway, if you look at the original, the top hat is in multiple different illustrations, and sometimes very prominent. In fact, it's right here. It's very small. I don't know.
Oh yeah, see. Yeah.
But it's sitting on a chair right next to him. It's almost as if the illustrator went out of his or her way, the illustrations aren't signed, to make sure that the top hat was there mm-hmm. to make it clear that Lacenaire was also this dandy, someone who really wanted to be an up-and-coming person in the world. And he himself also felt a sense of injustice at the world, anger and resentment, because his family had lost its fortune. So mm-hmm. something that he thought was his right was taken away from him by forces beyond his control. And his actions are a form of revenge upon a society that would do that to him. And so that part of Lacenaire is very much imported into Raskolnikov.
The Lacenaire connection was new to me, and I've taught this novel a lot, but I've never come across that before. I usually think of it in terms of Raskolnikov's ambition, in terms of mm-hmm. What he says to another character, Porfiry Petrovich. It's about Napoleon. You want to step over, you want to not obey the rules, mm-hmm. but to have this actual murderer in there, it gives it an extra degree of horror, really.
So the thing that fascinated, there were a lot of things about Lacenaire's story that fascinated Dostoevsky when he read it. The first is that he was a cold-blooded killer. He killed without compunction. He said, mm-hmm. I kill a man as I drink a glass of wine. He seemed to have no feeling for the fact that he killed people.
He didn't lose his composure the way that Raskolnikov does.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah.
However, that's not ultimately what disturbed Dostoevsky. What disturbed him was that when his trial took place in Paris in 1835, he became a celebrity among certain mm-hmm. people in France. Crowds came to visit him at his trial. People were going to his prison cell to interview him. People were sending him gifts and flowers. People were writing him poetry. When he was executed, crowds went to the execution, which is not too uncommon, but one of his hands was taken off and mummified and was circulating around literary circles in Paris. And it's because he was able to sell the idea that he was doing it for altruistic purposes, that he was committing these crimes in order to right the wrongs of an unjust society. Now, what Dostoevsky saw and what he primarily took from Lacenaire into Crime and Punishment was the notion of an ideological murderer or murderer for altruism that would be very persuasive to some people, but that beneath all of that was nothing. It was really a pointless crime. It was these are fake motives. These are motives that really just flatter base instincts. And it's the mm-hmm. base instincts that Dostoevsky thought were at the heart of a lot of the crimes that he was investigating, because when he was in Siberia, he was constantly talking to his fellow convicts. He was meeting and discussing murder with actual murderers. That was sort of his training ground as a crime novelist, was actually talking to criminals. And they would kill people for a wide variety of reasons. There was no commonality to the reasons why they stated they would kill someone. But the common factor within it, Dostoevsky wrote in Notes from a Dead House, his memoir of his Siberian prison years.
Which is a great, great book that is too little read. It is one of his, I prefer it to, it's heresy, but I prefer it to Karamazov or to it's a fabulous book. Yeah.
When Tolstoy read it, he asked a mutual friend, they had never met. Tolstoy and Dostoevsky never actually met in person, but he said, please tell Dostoevsky I love him. He loved Dead House so much. But it was the impulse beneath all of the excuses that really struck him. And he realized that it was a compulsion to be free, that these are people who wanted some sense of freedom and power mm-hmm. and control over their lives, even if it was only for a second, even if they knew they would be punished for it, they wanted it and they craved that sense of freedom, that there is a perverse sense of freedom that comes with just wiping everything away, with creating a tabula rasa, with destroying mm-hmm. all society or destroying a person around you. And even if it ultimately is self-destructive, for some people, it was worth that sense of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had an uncanny ability to get people to talk to him.
Yeah,
he was a great reporter. As a lot of 19th century novelists are, he was a great reporter.
And he was good at getting a captive audience too, because most of the stories he got were in the hospital. So yeah. Dostoevsky started suffering from temporal lobe epilepsy and was getting seizures frequently. And so frequently was taken to the prison hospital. And in the prison hospital, it's like paradise in Siberia, because you don't mm-hmm. have to work. And, you know, the food may not be great and it may be cold and the bed is probably not so good, but it's way better than the prison barracks. And you had people who were basically sitting around for a long time and you got to know them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And he kept a prison notebook that he hid in the hospital because he wasn't allowed to write. It was illegal to write anything. It was illegal to read anything except for the Bible. Mm-hmm. But he was able to read as well, because the hospital staff was helping him out. But it was in the hospital that he was able to get these stories from these convicts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, a literally captive audience. It's captive in several ways. I want to switch focus a little bit and go back to something you and I were talking about earlier today. I mentioned Raskolnikov believing that he would be perfectly calm. Yeah. And you were telling me earlier today that Dostoevsky himself had moments where he believed if he could only be perfectly calm right. and rational, that everything would be okay. And I'm thinking here of his gambling.
Right.
Yes. And can you tell us about, because the gambling is going on while he's writing Crime and Punishment. That's one of the reasons why, right. why he has to do it and make it a success, is because he's gotten in such debts from gambling.
Right. So among the many trials and tribulations of Dostoevsky's life is a growing addiction to gambling, particularly roulette. And that addiction was so powerful. When you read the letters that he was writing to his second wife in those later years, it's just sad to see how he was effectively throwing his life away, or, you know, making his entire family destitute in order to try to save them with money. But I did want to talk about gambling in a fairly detailed way. I wanted people to be able to see it through Dostoevsky's eyes, to mm-hmm. understand how he felt when he was gambling, in order for us to see what kept going wrong in his life. So mm-hmm. There's one scene, and I'll sort of set it up. This is the start of chapter 14 in my book, and it takes place in 1863. And it's one of the difficult moments in Dostoevsky's life, because the magazine that he started with his brother, called Time, has just been shut down by the Tsar. And, you know, this was going to be the instrument of his literary resurrection. And of course, he had a literary resurrection anyway, but it was a huge hardship for him. And he and his brother were both undergoing severe debt. And the debts just got worse and worse as time went on. And his wife, his first wife, was ill with tuberculosis, and her illness was getting a lot worse. And there was political turmoil at home, and his response to all of this, to all of the pressure, was to escape. And he decides to escape to Europe, but specifically to a casino in Wiesbaden, Germany. And he decides to play roulette because he thinks that roulette will be his salvation. So here's, I'm just going to read, it's just a couple of paragraphs. It's very brief, but just to give you a sense of what gambling was like for Dostoevsky, here it is, the beginning of chapter 14. Winning at roulette is easy. The secret is to maintain complete control over your emotions at all times, to be a machine. You must have no feeling at all for the francs and guilders and Napoleons raked in and shoveled out across the table. You must remain indifferent to the deliciously clinking gold and silver and the rising or falling stacks in front of you, so that when you see the wheels spinning and hear the ivory ball coursing around the track as the wagers accumulate, following it as it noses down into the wheel's bowl, tick, tack, tacking across the numbers, red, red, black, red, you can remain calm. And whether it hunkers into 31 or skips belatedly to 27, you will not be disturbed. You will keep your head. For days, Dostoevsky watched hundreds of gamblers muscling their way through the crowd to place bets. Rouge, Ampere, Monk. Some of them recorded the results in notepads and scanned for patterns. A streak of reds, two 11s, a full hour without a single zero. This was helpful. But most gamblers are impetuous. They come and go like pebbles on the shore. To win, you have to play for days, endure hundreds of spins, thousands. You have to ride out the bad turns patiently so that you can take advantage when momentum shifts. Resolve like that requires an iron constitution. It requires determination and faith. Dostoevsky learned the secret to roulette by studying a stoic French woman and an English lord who nearly broke the bank. If you could keep their level of imperturbable control, Dostoevsky explains in a letter, then it's impossible to lose and you're certain to win. He called it his system. So Dostoevsky, if you were to talk to Dostoevsky outside of a casino, if he's back home in St. Petersburg, and asked him, is it possible for you to win at roulette? He probably would have said, no, you can't do it. But he kept convincing himself that he could. Even though he knew there was no way to do it, he kept going back over and over again, trying to relearn the same thing and failing to do it. And it's the heartbreaking, one of the heartbreaking things about Dostoevsky's life is that he knew he was irrational. He knew he was a creature who was driven by his own emotions. He couldn't be calm and imperturbable. He couldn't be a machine. And yet he pretended that he could. But even knowing that he was irrational, even knowing that he was full of emotions, that didn't make him any more rational. It didn't give him any more control over his emotions. You can be aware of who you are, and it's still a cage that you're trapped in. And this, the lure of being able to free yourself from years of hardships in one fell swoop, it's not very unlike a murder, right? Yeah. Years and years of hardships that build up. And what if I can just imagine a single moment, one coup that would change everything? That is the thrill that Raskolnikov is looking for. That is the thrill that the convicts in Siberia were looking for, that Dostoevsky spoke with. That was the thrill that Dostoevsky himself was looking for when he went to the gambling tables. And the sad thing about that gambling experience in 1863 is that he won. It was the worst thing that could have happened to him, because he kept trying to repeat that moment of power for the rest of his life, and he kept failing over and over again.
Yeah, and roulette is not something you get good at.
No, it's,
you know, I mean, it's you, I guess you, I don't play poker, but you can get good at poker. You can sort of get good at blackjack or even at craps, but not at roulette.
It's the simplest, you know, mathematical game, and the house always wins because zero belongs to the house. If you look at a roulette wheel, zero is always the house's wheel. And that one little number tilts the balance in their favor. I think it's like 52% or something like that. And you're never going to win.
Yeah, no. But you, as you're talking about his always talking himself back into the idea that he can do it, that this time it will be different. Right. It's also part of what gives him his power as a writer. And I'm thinking here that, you know, in every one of his major novels, there's a debate between faith and atheism. You know, and the thing is, it's never a canned debate.
No.
He always chooses faith.
But
you think as you're reading that at any time he could go the other way.
He really feels it. He really feels it. You know, and we were talking earlier about how he would choose to be with Christ even if it were false rather than the truth. You know, part of the character of his faith is that he also knew that he would always be a creature of doubt, as he called it. Mm-hmm. I will always be a creature of doubt, and I can't get away from it, no matter how much I believe. And, you know, when people talk about the voices in Dostoevsky being real, full-blooded, embodied voices, it's partly because he really felt all of these voices. Because when he thinks in the mind of a murderer, it's because he's experienced those thoughts himself, and he's candid with himself in a way that most of us aren't candid. And he doesn't pretend that he's a logical, rational person. You know, these days, I think it's pretty common for us to accept that human beings are irrational to some degree, but it's important for us to remember that Dostoevsky was writing at a time when the notion of human beings being rational was very powerful. It was very, it was a dominant idea. And this was, it was buttressed by pseudoscience. It was buttressed by bizarre understandings of Darwin, that, you know, things were going to be trending towards perfection. And that perfection was based on the fact that human beings are machines to some degree. There are machines that maximize their own pleasure, machines that are going to evolve. And Dostoevsky said, no, you don't even know what is going to make you happy. Yeah. You are blind to what makes you happy. Even if you did know what made you happy, you often work against yourself. You often do the things that don't make you happy. You spite yourself. You spite other people.
I'm going to steal a little bit from Conrad here, from Joseph Conrad here, and who hated Dostoevsky, by the way. When Conrad was writing, it was sort of news to people that we all have a heart of darkness. They in 19th century rationalism had forgotten that. But Conrad knew it, and Dostoevsky knew it, and
you weren't supposed to admit it. You were supposed to at least be innocent. You yourself were innocent, whereas other people, you know, the criminals. One of the things that Dostoevsky, or one of the things that Paris in general, found fascinating about Lacenaire is that he didn't seem like a typical criminal, right? Because criminals were turned into this separate class, almost subhuman people who were supposed to be very different from you. They're operating in some distant underworld. And here was a criminal who was well-educated, who was handsome, who was eloquent, who was stylish. And that was bizarre. And that bizarreness, for Dostoevsky, wasn't bizarre at all. It was a good representation of the impulses that he thought might bring down European civilization, that could potentially bring down Russian civilization.
We've got some good questions in the Q&A, and some of them pick up on Lacenaire. So I'm going to go to those in a minute, but I want to ask you one further question, and it's sort of a simple one, I guess. What was the hardest part of writing the book?
I was stuck in Siberia for years. I was researching Siberia for ages, and I'm not sure how I got there. I'm not sure why I didn't get out earlier than I should have, but I didn't. And I kept reading and reading and researching, and it was just so, I shouldn't have done it in retrospect. It took me 7 years to write this book. The book probably should have taken me, 4 or 5 years. It was partly because Siberia had just opened up as a topic. And I wrote, I think about 160,000 words for one of the drafts of this book. It's much shorter now. We cut probably about 50,000 words. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was Siberia. And I think what it was, and this may speak a little bit to your work as well, that because you have a book out we should mention about Faulkner called The Saddest Words. I have it right here. This is my copy of it.
Thank you.
William Faulkner's Civil War. And it's one of the things that's breathtaking about it is the scope of it. It's just such a broad scope. It not only traverses the entirety of Faulkner's career, but it does so within the context of the Civil War, the entire Civil War. So it's this massive theater, and you do this tremendous job of making it manageable and bringing it down to size. For me, Siberia became a massive theater, mm-hmm. and I eventually wrestled it down, but it was way more difficult for me to wrestle down than I had imagined.
But your Siberia chapters are among the best in the book. They are so vivid and so evocative. It's one of the high points.
Oh, good.
To read about the whole process of the forced marches the prisoners had to undertake to get to Siberia.
Right.
That was a wonderful piece of writing, extraordinary piece of writing.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, let's go to these questions now, and a couple of them are on Lacenaire, and one Robert Thompson writes that he'd love to hear more about Lacenaire's life and how he came to believe that murder was salutary. Are we sure it wasn't a pose? And then he wants to, was he unwell? But and maybe that's pretty clear. But yeah, how did he come to these ideas?
So the murders take place in 1834, mm-hmm. and the trial takes place in 1835. It's important to remember that we are only about 14 years away from revolutions that would sweep across the entire continent.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that you could commit violence for the good of society was really starting to gain steam.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the newspapers all picked up on at the trial was that when Lacenaire was waiting for one of his victims outside of this apartment that was a decoy apartment, he was luring collection clerks of banks up into apartments. And the plan was to murder them and take the banknotes that were in their mm-hmm. satchels. As he was waiting for one of the clerks to arrive, he was reading Rousseau's The Social Contract. Now, I suppose these days people would say, oh, that's sort of bizarre, but it wouldn't really ring any bells. At the time, it rang a lot of bells for a lot of people because Rousseau was a dangerous writer, someone who was potentially anti-monarchical and who was interested in reforming not only France, but the entirety of Europe. He was also affiliated with Republican politicians. He would write songs that were critical of the king. So there was a lot to draw from that made him seem as if he was a revolutionary, some sort of proto-revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And the logic seemed to be clear. A lot of people at that time had already accepted that it was possible to kill the king for the benefit of your society if the king is unjust. But that logic started to expand very quickly. Well, if you can kill the king, why not kill a banker if the banking system is unjust? And if you can kill a banker, why not kill the banker's clerks, right? So it was easy to see how the notion of one individual's revolutionary violence might be at least justified as a form of revolution. And it was when it was discussed, it was discussed in those terms as someone who was trying to attack all of society.
Reading Rousseau would automatically make somebody seem like maybe more of an intellectual than they might have been in fact.
And he was curious. He was a reader. He was largely self-educated. Like Raskolnikov, he intended to study the law, but was not able to study the law because he couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. He couldn't afford it because in Lacenaire's case, his family had gone bankrupt. Mm-hmm. He really was a poet. He wasn't the greatest of poets, but he was a reasonably good poet. And he was eloquent and effectively self-educated and was a great reader of novels, a great reader of poetry, and a reader of the philosophes of, you know, was interested in the Enlightenment and very interested in Rousseau.
There's a related question here, and somebody, Paul Russell, wants to know is if the character of the underground man in Dostoevsky's immediately preceding work was an earlier iteration of Lacenaire.
Yeah, of Lacenaire? I don't know. I think the questioner also thinks, I think of the underground man as being a precursor to Raskolnikov.
Okay.
I think that voice, so for anyone who has not read Dostoevsky in a long time, or maybe has never read Dostoevsky, Michael and I have already put in our recommendation for Notes from a Dead House. The other option, if you just want to dip your toe in, would be Notes from Underground. It's you get a lot of bang for your buck because it's really about 80 to 90 pages, but it's such an intense 80 to 90 pages. It was so bizarre when it came out that no one reviewed it. There were no reviews of Notes from Underground. And it's because the first 40 pages or so, nothing happens. It's just a voice speaking. And it's this voice of a would-be intellectual who is resentful and who is, you can feel that seething resentment that would eventually turn into violence in Crime and Punishment, but doesn't quite do that in Notes from Underground. So I do think the questioner is right in thinking of Notes from Underground as an early draft of Crime and Punishment, but I don't have any evidence, or at least I can't think of any evidence that would make us think that the Underground Man is also modeled off of Lacenaire in particular.
And then what happens in the Underground Man is that another character comes on. I think a prostitute, as I'm remembering, and their conversations are what makes the work snap to life.
Yeah.
And with Raskolnikov, it's there's always somebody coming into that lonely room of his to ask him a question and to bother him and to trouble him. And he wants to be alone in his misery and he never can be. And that just makes it worse.
Right. Community drawing him back in.
Yeah. We've had some questions too, given that we're offering suggestions for reading about suggestions or preferences for English translations of Dostoevsky.
Well, so I use the Pevyarov Volokonsky translation, which it was a difficult choice for me to make. I partly do that because it's the dominant translation, I think, in English today, and it's the one that's most likely to be used in universities and in high schools. The Oliver Reddy translation that came out, I guess it's about 5 years ago at this point, is also excellent. I think you probably can't go wrong with either of those translations. Pevyarov and Volokonsky tends to be a little bit more literal than Oliver Reddy. So if you want something that's slightly more literal, you would go with that translation. But Oliver Reddy's translation has a great sense of rhythm and a naturalness to it. So you know, every translator basically has to choose between, you know, a literal like adherence to the original language versus being creative in a way to adapt to the translated language. And so you can see them all basically occupying two different points on that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And from the mid-20th century, the one that seems most present still in print in some penguins is David Mangarshik.
When you teach it, what do you?
I do the Pevyarov and Volokonsky. I used to, the first time I taught it, I used whatever translation was in the Norton Critical Literature edition. And I forget what that was. And now I use the Pevyarov and Volokonsky, which seems vibrant to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple of people have been asking also about the origins of this project. And you know, that's the question people always want to know. How did this How did you choose Dostoevsky? What drew you to him?
Yeah.
Is going into such dark places difficult? But what really pulled you toward writing this particular book?
So going into the dark places was very difficult, and I didn't expect going there at the beginning of the project. So the project began partly just with a fascination with Dostoevsky's life. For a long time, I thought, it would be so great to write about Dostoevsky. Here we have a writer who, at the age of 24, before he'd even officially published anything, he was being celebrated as Russia's next great writer, you know, 24 years old. Fast forward 4 years, and he's being panned by the critics. People are turning against him. He's starting to dabble into politics, partly because he's frustrated with what's happening with his literary career. And suddenly he's arrested. And he's a convict, and he's basically persona non grata throughout the realm. And he disappears for 10 years and then bursts back onto the scene in 1860. And this second act of his career is the greatest act ever. It's, you know, everything that we read, except for the double, but virtually everything that we read today from Dostoevsky is after Siberia. That pre-Siberian iteration, or the pre-Siberian origin of his career, is just... it just doesn't speak to us the way that the post-Siberian Dostoevsky does. There's so much growth that happened by stepping away. And anyway, so for those of you who have not read deeply into Dostoevsky's life, there is a massive 5-volume biography by Joseph Frank. It's about 2,500 pages. I was reading that biography. Tucked into those 2,500 pages is one paragraph about Lacenaire and about the influence that Lacenaire had on Crime and Punishment. I became curious about this. And when I just did a little bit of digging, I realized, Lacenaire actually wrote his own memoirs. So in between the time that he was on trial and the time that he was guillotined, he was dashing off his memoirs as quickly as possible. And when I started reading those, I thought, you know, I think there's a way to do this, to tell Dostoevsky's story through this dual lens and to make it about the making of Crime and Punishment, where, you know, as you know, Michael, I don't like to do A to Z biographies of people. I like to pull out, I think, crucial portions of a writer's life and to be able to stick to that. I think it gives me more freedom and allows me to go into a bit more depth.
We both like to tell stories about books rather than stories about lives.
That's right. And, you know, I think, you know, people, part of how we got to know each other is that when my first book came out, The Most Dangerous Book, which is about James Joyce's Ulysses, people were comparing it to the book that you had recently written, Portrait of a Novel, which is about Henry James's A Portrait of a Lady. And both of those books were basically telling stories radiating out from the creation of a great novel, of one great novel, and using this tight lens to view a hopefully deep and rewarding vista of, you know, whether it's American culture or transatlantic culture or Irish culture or modernism or whatever.
Censorship in the case of the Joyce, which... You said so many interesting things about.
Right.
So we've got one more question, and this is a tricky one, I think. But given the current political climate in Russia, what's Dostoevsky's reputation there now?
Yeah, he's celebrating. Look, the thing about Dostoevsky is that you can pick out whatever you want to make him say. Well, if you're being irresponsible, he can say what you want him to say. Because, as you mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the hour, that, you know, Dostoevsky ended up becoming more and more conservative as the years went on, he is very amenable to an authoritarian like Putin to be used for those purposes. So, you know, anything that smacks of the greatness of Russia's past is something that an authoritarian would use to burnish their power and to promote some sense of nationalistic superiority. And Dostoevsky was not shy about thinking of Russia as a savior for Europe, right? So a lot of the visions that Dostoevsky had for Russia were visions that a lot of Russians still have today, whether they're conservative or liberal, but especially the conservatives. I mean, a lot of Russians, you know, thought of Russia as being the bulwark of the European continent, that they were the empire that had saved Europe from the Mongols, even though that's not true, that they were
the third Rome, they thought of it as.
That's right. Yeah. Moscow is the third Rome, they called it. Yeah. And, you know, that they were protecting Christianity in a way that the European powers were no longer protecting Christianity. So that was part of the Crimean War dispute. So it's, I guess that's a partial way of answering that very difficult but important question.
But I think that makes sense, though, that that he would be in Putin's Russia, he'd be on the on top. Under the Soviets, the Soviets were not wild about Dostoevsky at all. They did not like the explicit religiosity, and they much preferred Tolstoy.
And his emphasis on free will and freedom and the problems of freedom, but also the allure of freedom, was not something that really jived well with the Soviets. And it's part of the reason, I think, why Dostoevsky enjoyed such a great renaissance in readership in the United States in the 50s and 60s. It was caught up in Cold War politics a little bit.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Michael, thank you so much for coming tonight. And the book is The Sitter and the Saint, Dostoevsky and the Gentleman Murderer Who Inspired a Masterpiece.
And don't forget to pick up The Saddest Words, which is great.
Well, thank you. It's published by Kevin's is published by Penguin, and good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.